The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Thursday morning. I begin with a warning to our friends in the Pacific Northwest who are listening in Seattle and Portland, Spokane, that you are in for a toaster of a weekend. The National Weather Service warning that historic highs on Sunday could approach 100 degrees in Seattle and 107 in Portland, the all-time high. So take your precautions now. The interesting thing about this, the mercury could reach 110 in Spokane on Monday, is that many in the Pacific Northwest, like many in Maine, do not have air conditioning. So heat waves occasionally come, but this sort of heat wave, not often. Be safe. The bipartisan group of senators are going to meet with Joe Biden today to talk about the framework on $974 billion of spending, including $579 billion of new spending on new projects and initiatives. It's been put together by a group of 10 senators led by the redoubtable Susan Collins. To my friends in Portland, Maine, listening on WGAN 560 AM and 98.5 FM, when I told you all last year you had to vote to put Susan Collins back into the Senate, it's because for initiatives like this, she is created. She really does lead in this case. There are other Republicans involved, the redoubtable Rob Portman, Bill Cassidy, Mitt Romney, and they will have to sell it to the caucus as a whole. But if Senator Collins is leading, it's very likely to get the Republican votes. The question is, will it get the Democratic votes? Because it does not raise the corporate income tax, which was the initial announced goal of the president. Hopefully it does not destroy stepped-up bases for individuals either, which would destroy family businesses, family wealth, family companies across the United States. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, yesterday admonished lawmakers over questions about critical theory at a Wednesday hearing. I will be talking with Congressman Mike Waltz, whose letter to West Point sparked that exchange a little bit later in the show. I'm sure you've seen it. I'll play it then. The biggest story of the day, the one with the longest implications, came from the Supreme Court yesterday in a little understood decision in something called Cedar Point Nursery. In Cedar Point Nursery, the Supreme Court struck down a California regulation granting union organizers access to farm workers on agricultural fields. But it extends much further than that. It revitalizes the Constitution's Fifth Amendment, made applicable to the state and local governments by the 14th Amendment, that requires compensation for physical and regulatory takings of property. What the Supreme Court said emphatically, 6-3, and this was the 6-3 divide that people have been waiting for that has not materialized in other cases because liberals decided not to fight. They said the Fifth Amendment means what it says, and if the government allows people to enter onto your property, they must pay you. The next step indicated in the opinion which will come is if the government evicts you from your property, as it does via the Federal Endangered Species Act or the Clean Water Act, it must pay you. So the Pacific Legal Foundation, my hat is off to you for bringing that case and defending Cedar Point's nursery. Huge opinion, huge decision, very little understood. I have a new op-ed in the Washington Post this morning on the landing page. I encourage you to send it everywhere. It's about regulating big tech. The Republican Study Committee had me to their retreat last week. The chairman of that group, the Representative Jim Banks of Indiana, will be joining me a little bit later in the program. And I took questions, and one of them was about, what do we do about big tech? And so I took what I told them and turned it into a column that is outraging some people and making other people say, I did not know that. And yes, I agree with you. Big tech was the subject of a half dozen bills that passed a congressional committee yesterday, the Judiciary Committee, and it wasn't the typical partisan split, and big tech presents cross-the-aisle issues. I encourage everyone to focus on the assault big tech is mounting on your personal data, your privacy, and the dossiers that they are compiling. By they, I mean Facebook and Google, Amazon to a lesser extent, mostly Facebook and Google, and the apps that they put on your Apple phone. The data that they are collecting on you is really quite astonishing and is a threat to everyone. In China now, Jack Ma is going to come under control of the Chinese Communist Party in ways he's never been before. And all the data that his Alibaba has collected will go over to the Chinese Communist Party. Data belongs to you, not to big tech. And Republicans ought to make that their defining policy. The Afghan government could collapse 6 months after the U.S. withdrawal, the new intelligence assessment says. 6 months. I'll also talk with Congressman Waltz and Jim Banks about getting the translators who assisted the United States out if they are in danger of falling into Taliban hands. Morgan Stanley will bar unvaccinated staff and clients from their New York office. That is COVID story number one. COVID story number two is a huge scandal, another black eye for the National Institute of Health. Chinese COVID-19 gene data that could have aided the pandemic research. Removed from the NIH database, reports the Wall Street Journal. Seattle scientist digs up deleted coronavirus genetic data, adding fuel to the COVID origin debate, reports the Washington Post. Scientist finds early virus sequences that had been mysteriously deleted, according to the New York Times. What happened? A Chinese researcher a year ago sent the genetic sequences from the alpha version, the original version of the COVID virus, 200 virus samples to the NIH. Then, sometime this year, that researcher asked for them back, and the NIH gave it to them. It is incredible that our government would do that, allowing the continued cover-up of the origins of the Wuhan virus. Now, it is true the NIH says that scientists who willingly give their data to the NIH can have it removed from the NIH. Well, there's an exception to every rule. And when a pandemic is threatening the globe, that exception does not apply. Luckily, this scientist on the West Coast found it in an earlier obscure policy paper and has posted it, necessary for the understanding of where the virus came from. Also suggests the secrecy with which the Chinese Communist Party protects its lab and its virology experiments. We have to be on guard, friends. They are about the business of gain-of-function research and new virus prediction and production. Not for weapons originally, but their release, accidental, negligently, recklessly, someday intentionally, a grave and existential risk to the world. It's unregulated, it is unwatched on in the Chinese Communist Party, not telling us anything about it and grabbing back and hiding whatever they can. Meanwhile, President Biden is pushing, according to the Financial Times, for high-level meetings with Beijing officials. And that just seems to me to be nuts. He wants to send Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary of State, responsible for the 1994 Korean nukes deal, which was a disaster, responsible in large part for President Obama's disastrous JCPOA in Vienna right now, negotiating zombie JCPOA. He wants to send her to Beijing. We will end up dropping all our inquiries about the Uyghurs in exchange for promises on climate reduction in 2090. In a rare move, however, Israel has joined Canada, the United States, and 37 other mostly Western countries in a Canadian-led initiative at the United Nations Human Rights Commission, condemning the treatment of the Muslim Uyghurs in China and demanding independent observers there in the Western Xinjiang region. Good for them, finally. But at the same time as we make progress, Berlin and Paris are proposing a reset for European Union relations with Moscow. Germany dominates Europe. Germany is going back to its historic position between the free West and the authoritarian Russia, and trying to be a broker and a superpower between them both. Finally, a story by Blackstone. Yesterday, I mentioned Blackstone is out there buying residential real estate. Well, now Stephen Schwarzman is making a bid for gold a different way by supporting American track and field with his largesse. Good for Steve Schwarzman.
Welcome
Back, America. My conversation with Congressman Waltz will be posted over at HughHewitt.com. The entire interview at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, the podcast I put up every day. I'm joined now by the governor of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson. Good morning, Governor. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Hugh. It is great to be with you this morning.
Well, I want to tell people you're a former United States attorney, a former congressman, a former head of DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and that matters a great deal in what we're about to talk about, and the Undersecretary of Homeland Security for the border and for transportation security, and now the governor of Arkansas. However, you are currently in the spotlight for urging the Congress to pass the Equal Act. Can you first tell us what the Equal Act does?
Very simply, it equalizes the punishment whether you have crack cocaine or powder cocaine. What happened back in the 80s when I was U.S. attorney under Reagan, actually, in 1986, crack cocaine became a great concern and a scare. And so we elevated the punishment to 100 to 1, the ratio as it would be as compared to powder cocaine if you possessed it. And over the course of time, Senator Sessions was one of the Republican leaders that helped reduce that down to 18 to 1, but we haven't finished the job yet. So even today, if someone, and of course the crack cocaine defendants are about 82% of them are African Americans, and the powder cocaine is predominantly white. And so there's a racial disparity there. And so it really undermines confidence in our system when you have unequal punishments for the same type of substance, and chemically they're the same. And so that's why it's called the Equal Act. I've pushed this not recently, but I've pushed it for 20 years, and it's a fairness issue. And as a conservative Republican, this is one of those things that we can speak out for as equal treatment under the law, and it builds confidence in our police and our criminal justice system. So I support that equal treatment.
Now, Governor, when I was a clerk in the way long ago time on the D.C. Circuit, Judge McKinnon, my judge, was on the Sentencing Commission. And the Sentencing Commission was a pretty broadly based group that came up with the sentencing guidelines, which are pretty rigid. Mm-hmm. Why did it originally strike people that crack cocaine was so much worse than white powder cocaine?
Well, actually, this is a congressional mandate. So Congress reacted to Lynn Bias's death, who was a college athlete who died of crack cocaine overdose. It just shocked everyone. And so they said, we've got to do something about this. So they put in these mandatory minimum sentences, but it started at a very low level of small amount of possession. All of a sudden, requires you to go to prison for 5 or 10 years. And so it started with Congress. The Sentencing Commission actually reviewed it later and made recommendations to equalize that and to adjust that. But one of the important things is, people say, well, crack cocaine, there's more violence associated with it. Well, the sentencing grid, as you know, Hugh, allows for, well, if there's possession of a gun, that's going to be a mandatory minimum. Or if there's more victims, they have the ability to give longer sentences for the violence. But we shouldn't do it based upon simply the quantity and the distinction between crack and powder.
Now, what I was getting at, I just genuinely don't know. When the First Step Act was before Congress, I opposed it until an amendment was made that upped the penalties for fentanyl distributors, because I think fentanyl is just like giving people death. Is there a difference in impact of crack cocaine and white powdered cocaine in the addiction and the death rate? Because the dealers of it in fentanyl should just never get out of jail again because they're dealing death. What about the differences between the forms of cocaine?
Well, that's a good question, and I agree 100% with you that we got to put our resources on fentanyl. That's what's causing death, and whenever the use, the seizures, the cases of crack and powder cocaine are not rising. They are leveling off, if anything, and might have made the case that they've gone down some. But the deaths have gone up of overdose because they're lacing it with fentanyl. And so fentanyl is absolutely the problem. And so, and whether that's, combined with crack cocaine or whether it's powder cocaine, fentanyl is what we need to put our resources on. And I agree, anything we can do to stop the flow of that, we've got to do.
Now, Governor Hutchinson, you've been involved in this from every side, in the DEA, in Congress, now as the governor of a state in a great state of Arkansas. Is the drug war simply not worth fighting anymore? Ought we to find something that people can use to alleviate their stress, loneliness, pain, whatever it is, their despair, that doesn't kill them? I mean, it's a little Orwellian, actually. It's a Brave New World, Soma, I think. But what do you think?
Well, I think we have to move away from drug war, and I think we have. It's a fight against illegal drug use and addiction, and you've got to stay in there. The key thing is you can't say these substances are legal because that just opens up the door for increased usage. But you always can look at the fairness of sentencing. You know, I'm a big promoter of drug treatment courts because they're alternative to prison time if you just got an addiction problem and you've got to have treatment. And so it's fair to look at that. But we still have to go after the source. I mean, we got a problem with Columbia still and cocaine coming out of there. So we got to be smart about it, but we can't give up on it because it really impacts lives. Just like you said, fentanyl. My goodness, that's part of our fight against illegal drugs and the death that it causes.
So when does the Equal Act come for a vote, Governor?
You know, that's undetermined right now. It's before the Senate Judiciary Committee. So it's sort of in Senator Grassley's hands. I hope that he will lean forward and help support that. He understands the issue. He's a leader, the ranking member on the committee. So I think they're waiting for hopefully his support on that.
Now, I want to reach back to your expertise on the border from your time at DHS. Vice President Harris announced yesterday she's going to the border. It's a pretty weird place on the border to go to. And Senator Cornyn has mocked her for that. What do you make of the Biden administration's policies on the border, Governor Hutchinson?
Well, they're awful. They sent every wrong signal. They've created a humanitarian crisis. I worked in the Bush administration on border issues, and we didn't have it perfect, but we understood you have to do everything you can to discourage that flow coming from Central America. President Biden, Kamala Harris has encouraged that flow by their language and then their policy. Whenever you say it sends every signal to them that despite our words, you all come on because we're going to let you in here. We're going to release you and you can stay in here and you're going to eventually have a path to citizenship. That's the wrong signal. And it's a true crisis on the border. Some of the governors are stepping up as to how we can help.
Governor Asa Hutchinson, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate your time, and I found it very interesting about the Equal Act. I was unaware of it, but you're persuasive, and I appreciate the time. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Hugh. Have a great day.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by former Senator Jim Talent. What represented the state of Missouri in the United States Senate is now with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Very frequently a guest commentator on matters relating to DOD. I'm wondering, Senator, if you saw General Miley's comments yesterday in the hearing before the House Armed Services Committee.
Is that regarding the criminal justice system, the whole issue of sexual assault, or is it a different?
No, that was on critical race theory. And General Miley was pushing back at Congressman Waltz, saying we got to read widely. Congressman
right.
Waltz was just on saying, yeah, read widely, but don't indoctrinate our cadets, which is what he is complaining about at West Point. Have you read up on that at all? Because the Service Academy's curriculum bothers me a lot more than the CNO's reading list.
Yes, exactly. I'm really concerned about it, you, especially since I think the armed forces are probably the most successful experiment in people of different backgrounds working together on behalf of a common mission that we have in the country. They've done a very effective job of integrating people from different backgrounds, racially and otherwise, in the military over the years. And I'm just deeply concerned about critical race theory in general, because when I read about it, what it seems to me to be is attaching negative stereotypes to people based on the color of their skin, which is racial prejudice. So, yeah, I'm very concerned about it and teaching it to people in any context.
Well, race consciousness in any way advocated by the federal government is unconstitutional. And there was one minor exception, which I believe this Supreme Court will erase, which was sometimes in admissions to law schools. You can, that's the only case on the record left. You can use race a little bit, but you can't make race determinative of anything if the government's involved. Well, the government's nowhere more involved in the education of a young person than at the military academies. And I do not believe it passes constitutional muster to indoctrinate people on critical race theory, understood correctly as a subdivision of critical legal studies at the academies.
Yeah, it is a highly reductive philosophy or approach of the world. It reduces people into two sets, oppressed and oppressors. And which set you're in depends upon identity markers, not what you are as an individual. And it encourages division based on factors and issues that should not divide people. And it's the opposite of what we want to achieve as a society, and which I was, you know, brought up to believe in, which is we try and treat people as individuals without regard to race. At least that's our aspirational goal. So this right, is my understanding of it, and I don't I can't think of an institution where it could be more damaging than the armed forces.
I agree. I want to switch, Senator, while I have you, to the new president of Iran. There's a huge article in Tablet magazine about who he is. He's a terrorist. He's a killer. He's an absolute awful human being. Why are we still in Vienna dealing with this regime when it is? And he's the successor of the Ayatollah Khamenei. Why would we trust them on anything ever, anywhere, on any time?
Yeah, although I think it's a little bit, I agree with you about Raisi. I mean, there's no other conclusion you can draw about him. I do think it is dangerous to indulge in what I think is 99% of fiction, that some of these presidents have been moderates and others have been hardliners. They are
agreed.
All pursuing, yeah, the national objectives of the regime, which is aggression in the region, attacking people in other countries who don't agree with them, and ultimately aimed at, at the United States. And to go in with negotiations with these people, when they declared that they want to get us, I've never understood it. I heard your interview with Congressman Gallagher, and he made exactly the same point. They are who we think they are. I think he had this discussion with Stab also. And so, no, I would not negotiate with them. But I think the Biden administration is on autopilot in its attempt to restore the JCPOA. And by the way, if you want to restore the JCPOA, if you want to get them to the table, don't give them concessions up front. They're simply going to wait to see how many concessions you give them before they have to come to the table. Why should
100%
they?
Agree. And while I've got you, Wendy Sherman is being sent by President Biden to China. Can you think of anyone less suited to this job than the individual who negotiated the 1994 nuclear agreement and the first JCPOA?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think she was following the policy of the commander-in-chief at the time and is
now. Of course.
So, in other words, I don't know if this is a question of whether it's Wendy Sherman or somebody else. Look, when we were talking about his summit with Putin, one of the things we discussed was these authoritarians don't care whether they're liked. They want to be feared. So this idea that we can, we can get them to change their ways by trying to rally world opinion against them, which is certainly a good thing to do, but it mistakes what their ultimate goals are and the means by which they want to achieve them. So, yeah, I'm very concerned about that also.
Well said, Jim Talent. People, follow him on Twitter at Jim Talent. Pretty easy to remember that. Senator, thank you. Always a pleasure. Coming back, America, another hour of the Thursday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, straight ahead. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So, if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We continue to follow the breaking news out of Florida, where a 12-story, 80-unit condo has collapsed. There's at least one dead, at least 10 hurt as they continue to go through the wreckage. I will update you as the morning progresses. I'm joined now by United States Senator Steve Daines of the great state of Montana. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, Hugh. Great to join you this morning.
The other major story this morning, besides the collapse of the condominium, is the Senate group reaches tentative deal with White House officials on infrastructure. What do you know, and when did you know it, Senator?
Well, I've been staying in pretty close communication with my colleagues who are in the middle of that group of bipartisan senators who are trying to find a way forward. I guess I'd say this to you. I'm glad to see at least they're focused on something that is actually infrastructure. It's bipartisan. And its infrastructure is defined by the common person on the street, not this craziness of free community college, free daycare, this social infrastructure that the left wants to move forward. So this is bridges, it's roads, it's broadband, it's ports, it's waterways. Of course, the devil being the details, the pay-fors are going to be always a potential sticking point. I do have concerns overall with the cost and the timing when we're looking at all the inflation red buttons are flashing, and what does that mean in terms of putting more competition of the federal government with the private sector as it relates to what's going on with the supply chain constraints that we see at the moment, rising interest rates potentially, and inflation. So more to come on that, but it looks like they're going to meet at the White House this morning, and we'll see where the president shakes out on this compromise that they've reached.
Now, Senator, I have great confidence in Susan Collins, and I tell my Portland, Maine audience that every day, and she's part maybe the key in this negotiation. But you said my first concern is that unless it's got cement and steel somewhere, it's not infrastructure. And so you better, even with broadband, you're using some cement and steel to get the broadband out further into rural America. And I know, for example, that there are parts of your state, Montana, where rural broadband is a necessity and needs to be delivered, and it's a big lift for a state government. That's the sort of stuff I think of when I think of infrastructure and, of course, the interstate system and harbors and roads and bridges.
Well, you think about for a moment about the global economy. You know, as you know, I spent 28 years in the private sector. I worked for Procter & Gamble, spent time in Asia, worked in the cloud computing business, managed Asia Pacific for 5 years in a software business. 95% of the world's consumers live outside the United States. When you think about a state like Montana, our number one economic driver is agriculture. So for us to have access to those 95% of the world's consumers, we've got to have robust infrastructure to get the American products, ag products, to markets. Most of them are overseas. So it is, I think it's an essential part of what we need to do for our country. Our infrastructure is crumbling. It's embarrassing at times when you travel abroad, you look at Europe, you look at parts of Asia where they've got much better infrastructure. And then here we are in the United States of America, the most robust, strongest, largest economy in the world. We're free. We lead the world in terms of innovation, and yet look at our infrastructure. It's crumbling. And then back to broadband, if you're not connected, you aren't part of the global economy.
Now, Senator, you also identify the second issue, which is the pay for it. What that is D.C. speak for how do we pay for the money we're about to spend. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you just print the money. And sometimes you raise taxes or you generate income other way. There are two things of particular concern to me. One are the corporate tax cuts that made us competitive again under President Trump. But Joe Biden also ran for office on eliminating something called stepped-up basis and giving a deduction for it instead. If that passes, farmers and small businesses across America, especially in Montana, small mining concerns, small farmers, small timber operators, and every American who's held a home for 20 years in any coastal area are going to get hammered. And at their death, they're going to have to sell their house, sell their businesses. Is that acceptable to you as any part of a compromise?
Absolutely not. It's not acceptable. And the only reason you've got Republicans at the table at the moment, a small group of our 50 Republicans, you've got 5 to 10 right now in the middle of this negotiation, is that changing anything regarding those 2017 tax cuts that we passed, that's got to be off the table. And so everything you just described there, Hugh, I call that a parade of horribles. That is off the table for this infrastructure package. Now, the concerns many of us have is, will there be a phase two infrastructure package that would only be passed with Democrats through reconciliation, which means they can get it done with 51 votes. Kamala Harris would break the tie. That would likely include the capital gains tax increases, the death tax deduction decreases, and removal of the step-up basis. But for now, the current package they're talking about, which is, you know, I'll call it the brick-and-mortar infrastructure package, does not have any changes to the tax cut to 17. In other words, there's no tax increase.
Now, yesterday, Senator Sanders says he has 50 votes for his reconciliation. I think of Senator Manchin, whose state, though it's far away from Montana, has an economy that is not dissimilar, mining and agriculture. And he knows what happens if stepped-up basis goes away. Everybody in West Virginia gets screwed who has a small concern of any sort. Have you talked to him about this? Does he share your view, and is Bernie blowing smoke?
Bernie blows smoke, and I'm not sure what kind of smoke it is most of the time. But I'll tell you, you know, Joe Manchin will be in a very, very difficult position. And yes, we've talked about that. Hugh, the death tax, first of all, I think is the most immoral tax on the books. You know, many countries don't even have a death tax. So it's immoral, and it would have a direct effect on the generational transfer of family businesses, and particularly ag farms and ranches in a place like Montana. But this capital gains tax increase, you look what they're going to do. They're going to more than double it. It would take the capital gains tax rate here in the United States north of 50% when you add the state component to it. We would have the highest capital gains tax rate for the OECD countries, which, I mean, that just makes no sense. I was raised under the, you know, more the Jack Kemp supply side type philosophy of economics. And capital gains, I think, is a tax. We shouldn't be looking at increasing it. We should actually be looking to continue to decrease it.
My friend Hank Adler wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about the Biden proposal on stepped up basis. It would crush so many millions of Americans. They'd have to sell everything. The kids would have to sell everything after parents die. Businesses, farms, houses, everything. And nobody knows it. And I'm afraid when they talk about holding the 2017 bill sacrosanct, stepped up basis would be part of the tax code for, I don't know, 70, 80, 100 years. It's just got to be eliminated from this bill, or Democrats will get crushed. But that won't do any good to the people who die in the interim.
No, absolutely. There have been studies done, Hugh, that if you took away the step-up basis, and that applies to the generational transfer here of family businesses, it actually reduces jobs because you've got families that have these businesses, whether it's agriculture or family businesses, then that have to start to sell off significant portion of it to pay the taxes on it. And that literally results in reduced number of jobs in our country. So it would be another headwind for the economy if that were to go forward. But again, to be clear, this current infrastructure deal they're talking about the White House does not include any of those horrible tax increases or change in the tax code. What I'm concerned about, the pressure's got to stay on people like Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and others at John Tester in Montana, because just one Democrat senator holds the keys to stopping this potentially second phase of an infrastructure bill, which will be this social infrastructure. This is the free daycare, free community college, and the huge increase in taxes. We have got to stop that.
But that's I cannot see your seatmate, Senator Tester, voting for an increase in the death tax or an abolition or a deduction for stepped-up basis. Senator, while I have you, I have a landing page column right now at the Washington Post on big tech. And people in the Republican Party split on big tech, but we'd have to stop them from looting our data. That's the point of my column. People can go read it. What's your position on big tech? And what do you think about them building these vast dossiers of information on Americans and selling it to each other to, quote, nudge us, close quote, in our behavior?
Yeah, Hugh, I read your column on the Washington Post this morning already. You are spot on. I am one of the leading senators on the issue of privacy and personal privacy, and that is an issue that brings Democrats and Republicans together. But what they are doing, and as you mentioned in your column, that literally they're listening to conversations. They've got technology, of course, that can take voice to text, and then they can do word searches there and apply that to marketing. That's why that sometimes you're shocked when you have a conversation with your spouse, and suddenly the next day or even that evening, you see advertising that's hitting your phone through social media platforms that is talking about what you just talked about with your spouse. That is an invasion of privacy, and that needs to stop.
Senator Dane, so glad to hear you're on the case there, because that's where the parties can unite and the Republican Party ought to lead. I'm glad that you are. Senator Steve Daines of Montana, thank you. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In today's Washington Post column over at the landing page, I have included a reference to the fact that a week ago tonight, I was speaking to the Republican Study Committee, courtesy of an invitation from Congressman Jim Banks, who joins me now, and those two events are unrelated. I didn't know you were coming on today, Congressman, when I wrote the column. I hope I accurately represented everything that happened there.
Well, Hugh, it was great to have you. We had a really good kickoff to our conservative member retreat. That you came to the dinner that evening. We had a great crowd of members and a lot of folks from the conservative movement on Thursday night. And then all day on Friday, we had thoughtful conversations with conservative members down at Mount Vernon about China-related issues, big tech issues, and immigration issues. And we really appreciate you coming and helping us kick it off.
Well, I say in the column that those are the three issues that in which you were seeking to achieve consensus. And I talk about my views on each. Did you? And first of all, let's tell people what the Republican Study Committee is, Congressman. You're the chairman of it for the two-year term underway right now. But what is it?
Well, we've been around for 48 years. In the 70s, the Republican Study Committee was created as the conservative caucus. It's ebbed and flowed and taken on different flavors over those 48 years. But at the moment, we're 155 members out of the 212 or 213 GOP conference. We are a policy organization. So, Hugh, what we do every day is we gather, we convene on in a weekly meeting, and then we have a staff who helps us evaluate every single bill that we vote on and present the conservative viewpoint. But at the moment, I believe more than ever before, RSC exists for this. We are charting the course to write the agenda for the Republican Party and the conservative movement moving forward in this unique moment. And I believe, as I said on Thursday night dinner, Hugh, if we effectively marry the party of Reagan with the party of Donald Trump, will win back the majority in a landslide and will be the majority party for a long time to come. And RSC, we're cooking up the recipe to do that.
And I agree with that. I want to add in the party of George W. Bush. I think every Republican and independent and many Democrats disaffected with the leftward lurch of the Democratic Party have to be a part of this. Let's walk through the three issues, Congressman. If we can start with big tech, because I devoted most of my time in the Washington Post today to big tech. What did the discussions arrive at? Because this is the most difficult terrain. Many Republicans do not like antitrust laws applied to companies simply because they are big. Many Republicans share my concern that big tech is predatory when it comes to data. There are other points of view. What emerged as, quote, consensus, if indeed one was able to be called that?
Well, the Democrats are doing us a favor, by the way, Hugh, as you wrote about in your column with this package of six bills that were marked up in the Judiciary Committee yesterday. We'll be voting on them on the floor coming soon. But the consensus on the Republican side, by the way, we believe at the Republican Study Committee, we can win on big tech if we focus first on protecting privacy and data rights. Secondly, if we go out of our way, do everything that we can to protect our kids. As a dad of three daughters, 11 and under, this is my top priority. As big tech companies are preying on our kids in a big way, how do we protect them in a way that they're not being protected currently? And then three, we've got to stop big tech from becoming overly powerful. And I know you and I both have read Shoshana Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism. The takeaway from that book for me is when she talks about how these big tech companies are hurting us like animals. They're turning us into animals. They're hurting us, and they're influencing our consumer behavior, but also our behavior as voters and in other ways that are dangerous to the future of this country. So that's where the consensus is. The six bills that are going to be on the floor are all bipartisan, and there's a lot of good that's in these bills, but they're a far cry from reaching those three points. There is a bill I want to draw attention to. My friend Greg Stubbe from Florida, who's one of our board members of the Republican Study Committee, has the Browser Act, which changes the paradigm from big tech companies forcing you to opt out of capitalizing on your data. Instead of opting out, it would force them to opt in. And, I, you know, that's the type of policy initiative or Republican study committee that we believe in, that we're going to push forward and become part of our platform.
That is great news. A lot of shared ground there. Again, people can go to the Post if they want to read my take. Let's talk about China, Congressman. What is the consensus position on the Chinese Communist Party and the defense spending necessary to counter it?
Well, in the Republican Study Committee, we believe a get tough on China approach is the only approach. And we had pollsters from On Message, Inc. come and present polling data to us at the conservative member retreat. And they were commissioned by Heritage Action, who sponsored our retreat, our consensus conservative retreat. And the takeaway from that polling, Hugh, was very revealing to me. I mean, the American voters at large, 48% of the American voters want us to take a sanctions and tariffs approach, or a get tough approach on China before we do anything else. I mean, you and I have talked about the Endless Frontier Act and some of the good and the bad that's in that legislation. If we're going to pass anything like that, we got to come to an agreement on a get tough approach. And at RSC, we're crafting a large portfolio of ideas that we can do just that we can present at the same time as the Endless Frontier Act is moving its way through the House. It's already passed out of the Senate. So at the same time, we believe yesterday we had Secretary Austin and Chief Milley in front of the Armed Services Committee. And the opening remarks by my mentor and the ranking member of the committee, Mike Rogers, was all about this. The Biden budget does not appropriately fund a military that can counter China. And every other way, the Biden budget grows the size and scope of the federal government, except for Homeland Security, and it cuts the Trump era defense budgets that we need to counter China. And that's just further proof that Republicans are on the right side, Democrats are on the wrong side. These are the winning issues that are going to help us win back the majority in a landslide.
Now, Congressman Banks, earlier today, had on Congressman Waltz, who was the target of one set of remarks by General Milley about white rage. And it's been widely reported and circulated everywhere. And, of course, he was aiming those at Green Beret and your fellow veteran, actually still active duty. Congressman Waltz, you might be active duty or reserve duty, too. What did you make of General Milley's comments? Congressman Waltz's are available at my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. But what did you think of General Milley's comments?
Yeah, the general was off base, Hugh. I mean, I question the CNO last week about adding a book to his reading list that he pushes out to all the sailors that preaches critical race theory. And this is a dangerous path forward for our military. I think General Milley, I think the Admiral Gilday, the CNO, I think all of these military leaders are missing the point. If we want to project American strength, we do that by projecting American patriotism. I also worry, Hugh, that if we're preaching this garbage to our troops, how do we do that at the same time as recruit the next generation of young men and women to put on the uniform, raise their right hand, and swear an oath to this country and know that they could potentially die in service to this country, if at the same time you're preaching them an ideology, an un-American ideology that preaches that America is rooted in evil and racism? I don't know how you accomplish that. And that's the question that I had for the general, for the admiral, for other military leaders that are coming before our committee. But let me also say on that front, because this is important, the polling that Brad Todd and On Message presented us at our conservative member retreat shows that critical race theory is the losing issue for Democrats in the midterm election. I mean, 79% of the American people, Republican, Democrat, Independent, 79%. Say, do not teach critical race theory in our schools. Definitely don't teach it in our military. And the Democrats are hugging this ideology. Republicans understand that this is dangerous. This is the winning issue, and we don't even have to have a strategy on it, because Democrats have created this dynamic that's going to win back the House majority for the Republicans in a big way.
This issue is as toxic for Democrats as defunding the police was in the last cycle. And Congressman Banks, I applaud the Republican Study Committee for getting there first, explaining what it is. I read through that polling data, and I was stunned by the data. And they're a good firm. Brad Todd's a very good pollster. The American people reject critical race theory overwhelmingly. It's not two-thirds. It's not three-quarters. It's nearly 80%. And my guess is that the 20% are, like General Milley, not aware of the indoctrination aspect. General Milley was talking about being wide read, that he read Lenin and Marx and Mao. That's different from being indoctrinated in something. And I talked about that with your colleague, Mike Waltz, and I know you agree with me. Being indoctrinated is different from being open.
I completely agree. I mean, if we lean in here, and our Republican Study Committee is going to do this, if we lean in and the Republicans are on the side of a renewal of American patriotism and Democrats continue to hug critical race theory, Hugh, I think we're going to win back the majority next year in a historic way, even more so than we won back the majority in 2010.
Well, it explains why cable TV and the thrall of CRT has just tanked. The American people don't believe it. They don't want to hear about it. They hate to be called racist. They don't believe it. They reject it. On immigration, Congressman Jim Banks, what was the consensus from the Republican Study Committee?
Well, I've never seen more consensus on an issue among Republicans than on this issue at this moment. And it all derives from the crisis at the border. By the way, President Trump has invited Republican Study Committee to go to the border with him next Wednesday. I'm going to do that. I'm taking 25 or so of my colleagues down to the border to highlight the catastrophe and crisis that's occurring there today, that's night and day, a night and day difference from what it was pre-January 20th. And you saw the announcement yesterday about Vice President Harris going on Friday, the announcement about them stripping Title 42. If you think it's a crisis today, just wait until they end Title 42 and allow families to accompany minors and then be brought in and ushered to different places around the country. This is a disaster for Democrats. The polling shows it. We know it intuitively. And the solutions are common sense. The solution and the consensus among House conservatives is to return to the policies that worked under Donald Trump, ending catch and release, building the border wall, and keeping in place laws like Title 42.
And stay in Mexico. That policy most important. Congressman Banks, thank you again for having me. I'm glad the column got it right. Great work. I think that agenda is a winning agenda, and I salute the RSC for being at the front of it. Jim Banks from Indiana, remarkable. An Indianan is coherent and calm, and we didn't talk football, so I didn't demonstrate he didn't know what he was talking about. You know, he's a Hoosier, so they just don't know anything about football, but we really like Congressman Banks. I also really like ReliefFactor.com, that time of the day that I point out for the third time. That ReliefFactor.com at $19.95 is a great bargain to try. They made it easy for people to try ReliefFactor.com. You don't have to break the bank. $19.95, 3-week starter pack. You take it for 3 weeks. If it doesn't work for you, fine. That will put you in a decided minority. Stop taking it. But if you find that those nagging aches and pains are diminished, if not gone, if you find your exercise is more productive, if you find that the workouts go longer, if you find that you recover faster from them, or if you find you get the peanut butter down easier without a pain in your elbow or a crick in your neck, then ReliefFactor.com is for you. Tens of thousands of people take ReliefFactor.com every day. So safe, so clinically tested, so long. I mean, people listen to this show. You might be a new listener today. It might be the first time. Three times a day I tell you about ReliefFactor.com. People who listen to me for the 10 years that they've been a sponsor know I've been taking it every day for 10 years. It's the only supplement I take. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. This is probably the broadcast platform on which China is discussed most obsessively because the Chinese Communist Party aims for global domination and hegemonic control, at least of the Far East and probably much, much more. James Homan has a new column in the Washington Post. He joins us now. James, your point, they also look for hegemony above us in the skies.
And these things can't be separated, Hugh. And I am so glad that you talk about China as much as you do on your program because, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, they just have launched a space station to compete with ours. They have a space plane that can fly in low Earth orbit. Obviously, during the Cold War, you know, we had things like Sputnik, which wasn't that big or significant, and that really got us off our duff. And this time we just, you know, obviously your listeners and you and I care, but we haven't seen the collective sense of urgency to respond to this threat because they're trying to militarize space. You know, they're the This is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party, which is why they launched their new space station to coincide with this. Yesterday, Xi Jinping was talking to the three members of the People's Liberation Army who were aboard the space station. They were saluting. They were talking in military terms. They're not messing around, and we shouldn't either.
Now, James Holman, if you go up to the average American and say, what do you think about the Land Rover on Mars? If they know anything about it, they'll think it's the one that we sent, and they'll be thumbs up. What an achievement. We're great. We're still ahead. They won't know anything about the Mars Land Rover that was sent there by the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. And that's the thing, is that China's the only other country that's been able to do that. They obviously were late to the game, but they're, you know, part of it is they're stealing all our technology. They're perpetrating a massive espionage operation in our country that we need to fight back against. And so they're trying to leapfrog us, and it's you're absolutely right. And they even kind of, they've been taunting us. It hasn't gotten enough attention, but the Chinese have been, you know, they call them selfies that the Mars rover is sending back, and they've talked about how theirs is better than ours. You know, this isn't just kind of an ego thing. This is a real national security issue.
Global News, their English paper propaganda outlet, which is Pravda without the stigma, does in fact taunt Americans every day. Their wolf warrior diplomats are out there challenging every day. Yesterday, incredibly, they blamed America for the virus. You know, James, I don't think that most of America quite gets that we are in Cold War 2.0 and they intend to win.
Right. And they have a long-term strategy. You know, they're thinking about the next generation. Too many of our politicians are thinking about the next election. And you know, it isn't just territorial claims. I think a lot of, you know, reasonably smart people know about the South China Sea and about Taiwan, but China's not stopping there. They have global ambitions to become a hegemon and to control the world.
Your column closes with this paragraph: half a century after the Cold War, in the face of a different communist threat, another new age is dawning. Yes, Russia remains a threat. The global pandemic is still with us. And red ink is spilling for decades to come. But for all the competing budget and political concerns, the martyred President John F. Kennedy's words feel freshly urgent. Do you think anybody is going to agree with you to the extent of changing their budget priorities to reflect the challenge abroad? Because that's where the rubber hits the road, James Holman. What do they spend money on?
Well, I'm actually quite pleased that on Capitol Hill, at least there's sort of a broad recognition that you have to say we should spend on our space program and on countering China. But they actually do have to do it. The Biden administration asked for, a 5% increase in NASA's budget year over year, which is really very little. Last year, Congress, I think the Trump administration asked for like four times what Congress gave them for our program to get a man back on the moon. So you're absolutely right. This is the rubber meets the road. We actually have to spend money. It's unfortunate. You and I are both deficit hawks, and I think there's a lot of things we could cut. But this is something. It's not just kind of for fun or for just exploration for exploration's sake. This is a battlefield that we have to be prepared to compete on.
Now, they have satellite-killing missiles. They have satellites that can reject our missiles-killing capability. They have a cyber espionage program that is unmatched. They have an influence operation in the United States, which is overwhelming. Your colleague, my colleague at the Washington Post in the columning business, Josh Rogan, details this in his new book, Chaos Under Heaven. Have you had a chance to read that yet, James?
I have. It's a fantastic book, yeah.
Fantastic. It's also chilling. But I don't think America gets it, James. I really don't think they get it, that this is not your father's China. It's not my dad's China. It's not weak, and they make a lot more than bicycles. They're sending 20 warships to sea every year. We're making 7.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, last week, the thing is, like, in these columns, Hugh, as you know, you don't get enough time to just, when you start writing out all the terrible bellicose things that China's doing every week, you know, you quickly run into your 800-word limit. And even last week, I know we talked about this on your show, but, you know, the sending the bombers, nuclear armed, could be nuclear armed bombers and fighter jets over into Taiwan airspace. You know, they're doing this to test our resolve. I was pleased that our Navy did send a freedom of navigation mission through the Taiwan Strait yesterday, but we need to send the message that we're not going to be weak in the face of Chinese aggression.
Very quickly, James, have the Chinese bots found your and troll you the way they troll me whenever I write about China?
Yes, they have. I'm being called a racist this morning.
All right, well, that's par for the course, James Homan. Thank you, my friend. Great column. I've tweeted it out. Go follow it. Go to my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, for the Michael Waltz interview, and come back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.